wanna give love to the city, that's a fact. But you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed, you want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Hi everyone, welcome to ECF's Well Endowed podcast. I'm Anna Alfonso.
And I'm Andrew Paul. Edmonton is full of generous donors who have created endowment funds at Edmonton Community Foundation.
These funds are carefully stewarded to generate money that supports charities in Edmonton and beyond.
On this podcast, we share stories about how these funds help strengthen our community, because it's good to be well endowed.
Okay, Andrew, so I have a question for you.
All right.
I'd like to know which women in your life are your biggest role models.
Oh my goodness, I don't even know where to start with this. I owe so much to the women in my life, and I've also noticed working in a lot of nonprofits, including theater and here at Edmonton Community Foundation, there are a lot of very talented, very cool women in leadership positions, and I have just been very lucky that they let me stick around, yourself included, Anna, to do the work that I do. And actually, my path to the nonprofit sector very much ties into my grandma on my dad's side, so my grandma Paul. And she was this incredible woman, had 12 kids, lived up in northern Alberta. And while raising 12 kids, I swear my grandma might have been pregnant for about 30 years straight, just doing the math on this one. She still found time to give back to her community and also to start and maintain a career as a freelance journalist for the local rural newspapers in like Grimshaw, Peace River, Fort Vermilion. And when I was coming out of high school and sort of in that gap year between grade 12 and figuring out what I was going to do for post-secondary, I started writing my own newspaper column for my local paper. And my grandma was scheduled for heart surgery. So she came down to stay with my aunt just outside of Stony Plain, where I was living at the time. And she asked everybody to come visit her at my aunt's house. And I think she kind of had a sense that the surgery might not go well. And we all were called up sort of one at a time for some one-on-one time with grandma in the bedroom upstairs. And I was sort of wondering, well, what should I do for school? You know, I like this writing thing, but there's like other options that, you know, were sort of there as well. You know, go work in the oil fields, or public health inspection was another thing.
Andrew, I cannot see you working in the oil fields.
I went upstairs and grandma had all of my newspaper clippings cut out sitting beside her on the bed.
Oh.
And she gave me her old dictionary and a copy of American Newspaper Style from 1956, sort of these little gifts. And that was sort of her blessing for me to go do this crazy thing, chasing stories for a living. And that sort of led me here. So I owe so much to Grandma Paul.
What an inspiration Grandma Paul is.
Yes.
Oh my. And so you kind of owe your current career to Grandma Paul.
I sure do. Absolutely. And how about you, Anna?
For me, I would say my mom, my aunts, immigrant mothers. I think that they make this really heart-wrenching decision to leave their families, their careers behind, to move to Canada so that their children could have better opportunities, so that we have more stability. So I was 5 when we moved here, and I just remember my parents doing so many different things than what we did in the Philippines. So going back to school, starting new careers, while also taking care of us, ensuring that we were learning English, me and my 2 siblings, and continuing to go to school, building our networks. So I think that I really admire their courage, their resilience, and hope to nurture a little bit of that in myself.
Moms are the best, aren't they?
Aren't they? They really are.
So I think this is a really great way to open this episode, which is part one of a very special panel conversation about women in leadership.
That's right. So over the next 2 episodes, we'll join Monel Sturko, ECF's board chair.
I am Monel Sturko. I am the chair of the board of directors for the Edmonton Community Foundation.
As she sits down with Yasmin Jivraj.
Hi, I'm Yasmin Jivraj. I'm a director at Dexent. It's an industrial automation company that I co-own.
And Michelle Okiri.
Hi, my name's Michelle Okiri. I'm principal of Okiri & Associates, and I also am co-founder of the REIT Institute.
for a conversation about women in leadership.
I must say, I'm not sure our podcast studio has ever been that packed with so much talent and experience at one time. We're in for a treat.
Well, let's get started, shall we? Over to you, Manel.
So I wanted to ask each of you if you could just quickly introduce yourselves and give us a little bit of background on who you are and why we are so fortunate to have you here today. Michelle?
Hi, my name's Michelle O'Curie. I'm principal of O'Curie & Associates, and I also am co-founder of the REIT Institute.
Hi, and I'm Yasmin Jivraj. I'm a director at Dexcent. It's an industrial automation company that I co-own, and I sit on numerous boards. I'm the chair of the board of governors at NATE. I sit on the board of Alberta Blue Cross and Alberta Foundation for the Arts currently.
Thank you both for being here today, and I am Monel Sturko. I am the chair of the board of directors for the Edmonton Community Foundation. I'm also fortunate to be chairing the governance committee for ECF, and in the daytime, I work as a litigator for DDC Lawyers. So we're here today to talk about a lot of things to do with women in leadership, and it's a broad, broad topic with so many questions, and we only have a limited amount of time. But before we got started, I was talking about being inspired to be in not-for-profit leadership. What does that look like and how the journey unfolded? I would just like to share quickly that my love and desire and understanding of why volunteering or not-for-profit is so important comes from growing up in a really small town. And it was a farming community where you just naturally help each other. And it comes very organically and is just an understanding because you're a small community and that requires people to just band together. So when I was able to join ECF as a board member, that was my foray into this unbelievable world of philanthropy and giving. And I had no idea how large the not-for-profit community is in this wonderful city and how many opportunities there were to be able to contribute and be a part of something bigger than yourself and to be able to really feel like you were making a difference. And so I would love to hear from both of you how this came to be, how it started, and how you are where you are now.
All right. So you want me to go first?
I do.
I was drawn to the nonprofit leadership at quite an early stage in my career. Soon after I graduated, I had a strong desire to make a difference, and I started with my professional society, the Canadian Information Processing Society, which that allowed me to focus on issues that I was passionate about, which was developing the IT professionals, modifying our professional designation so that as technology and businesses are changing, it's keeping up with that. I then went on other nonprofit organizations like the board of Aga Khan Foundation Canada. It's a nonprofit international development agency. Then I was in my mid-30s appointed on the board of CBC Radio Canada. And so the journey continued on. And I did not realize how much it developed me as an individual, me as a leader, sitting amongst really successful people, successful owners and business executives, making key decisions, bigger decisions that had bigger impact in life. So I was really, really, really drawn into helping the nonprofits. And I really liked the values, the principles that were all focused towards bringing better community outcomes, better outcomes for society. And so my love continued, and it is there up to today.
That's wonderful. I understand exactly what you're saying. I was thinking to myself, she's so right. Sitting at the board table with all of these exceptional people who have so much expertise in everything they do and outside of the board really did, I think, elevate me and inspire me to want to try harder and accomplish more. And it really was inspiring as a group to be able to have that momentum. Michelle?
My story is a little bit different than both of yours in that, you know, while I similarly grew up in a small town, and I think I saw the value of community in that, I grew up very much in poverty. I was between small town Saskatchewan, and my dad was an RCMP officer at a time when they really wanted Indigenous representation, especially on reserve. So we were kind of in between small town Sask and different rural and remote reserves. And so I saw the disparity there, poverty, and I experienced that once my parents separated. And so I was only able to participate in a lot of things through the nonprofits and other things in our communities. So I played baseball at a really high level because of kids sport. And that's something that I didn't really realize at the time was such a profound impact on me. You know, I was the first person in my family to go to university. I had no idea what I was going to do. You know, I was actually at the end of my third year where someone called me from the student advisor office and said, you need to pick a major. And I said, oh, do I? I thought if I just went here for 4 years, you gave me a degree and then someone gave me a good job. And but I was so naive to it because no one had ever been through that before.
Right.
And so when I got out, I had this double major in political science and history, no idea what I wanted to do with it. And I started working in policy and research and I was deathly bored. It's not my personality at all. But from there, I got a public relations degree and I actually had my first job at a community foundation, the South Sask Community Foundation in Regina. And then I got to go out and learn all about these organizations and help tell their stories and the impact that we were making in the community. And I thought, you get to do this for a living?
Right.
Wow. That is so powerful. I want to do this. And so I was 23 and I had absolutely no business aspiring to this, but I said, I'm going to run one of these one day. And so I started reaching out to all of the people in leadership that I knew across the country, people I'd, you know, seen at conferences, heard about, thought leaders. And it was still early days of LinkedIn, but I found them and I'd reach out to them and say, hey, do you have 15 or 20 minutes that I can pick your brain? And when you're young like that and you are aspiring for something in that way, people are so happy to give you that time, to mentor you, to support you. And so they gave me the roadmap. And so I was very fortunate that I followed that. You know, I got involved with my local AFP chapter, got involved on the board there. I worked towards my certified fundraising executive designation, and I got very involved in fundraising. And when my husband and I moved to Edmonton 5 years ago, I came for a job to be the CEO of Compassion House Foundation. And so I was able to accomplish that really at quite a young age. I held leadership roles quite early, even before that. And for me, it was just so powerful to know that you could have that kind of impact on people's lives. And I've been involved in a lot of different boards. I'm the chair of PolicyWise for Children and Families right now. I'm the Truth and Reconciliation chair for the YWCA Edmonton. I'm also on the U of A Senate, as well as a co-founder of another nonprofit. So it's something that I'm really passionate about, but it really comes from that lived experience and that understanding of what it's like to be on the receiving end.
That's an amazing story, Michelle, and I think Yasmin too. So when I think about what you've both just said, I feel like sometimes the real question is, what is it that drives you forward? Certainly for me, being in both of my families, the first female lawyer, and putting myself through law school and having that struggle and understanding why that drive is so deep. I would say similarly, my drive to help others partially comes from that, because I think when you do understand a dream or a desire or something that strong and palpable, you're prepared to do whatever it takes. And so I'm wondering if both of you would be able to talk a little bit about something harder that you've encountered being women in leadership.
Yeah, I can jump in here. I think because I ascended in my career as young as I did, you know, even before moving here, I was regional manager for the Prairies for MAD Canada, and I was often the one who was in rooms with government advocating for legislation around drug-impaired driving and working on the legislation when cannabis was legalized. I was doing media scrums where everyone's got, you know, their 30 microphones in your face, and you're not sure who you're supposed to be looking at and where the questions are coming from. And it doesn't matter because everyone's kind of got their slant on that, and they have to get their quick quote that they're going to, you know, oftentimes drag you through the mud around. And I actually had a MAD Canada phone at home because they had to have a line that they could get a hold of me on. And I was home office, you know, I was one of the few across the country that worked from home. And I remember a Saskatchewan Rough Rider that had, I think he blew 3 to 4 times the legal limit. He was actually passed out in his vehicle when the police found him. And big news story, but he was a star. And if you know anything about Saskatchewan, they love their Rough Riders. And so, of course, they come to me for a quote, being the representative on the Prairies. And we had just brought in really, you know, the strongest legislation in Canada. And I had to come down hard on this. And I think it was the right thing to do. But people found my number after seeing these quotes in the media. And they were calling me at home and saying, you know, this is a young man. He made a mistake. He should be on the field. You know, but coming at me personally on, you know, how harsh I had been. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm a 28-year-old girl on the other end of this. And you're worried about what this 34-year-old man making mistakes is, but coming at me so aggressively. And so I found that in different rooms, that the way that people would talk to you was so different. And, you know, having watched my husband's career, often being in leadership positions quite early as well, I never saw people approach him with the same level of like vitriol and aggression. I would have people come up to me publicly because I was doing so much media and my face was out there, and have things to say to me when I was out for, you know, dinner with friends or my husband or other things like that. And so it was really interesting, even working in a space where you felt like, oh, we're doing really good work here. We're, you know, we're helping to stop impaired driving and we're supporting victims. And yet the kind of negative consequences that came with it on the other side were just really surprising to me. And you had to build up a little bit of resilience in dealing with that as well.
Right, for sure.
Well, my story is a little bit different. I had to survive in that world. So my background is information technology. It's dominated by men. There's just very few women in the industry, and we're still working with STEM to get the numbers up. So working with the industry that's really male-dominated, sometimes you have to behave and be in the areas where decisions are made. So very early on, we had to learn that. And then we start bringing in our styles as we get credibility. Women have many responsibilities. Looking after their family is very, very important. I had my family very early on, and looking after their well-being came number one. But I also wanted to do run businesses and also help professional organizations and other boards do that. So how do we do all of that together? Right. We had to look at different ways. We had to look at different styles. We had to look at breaking different barriers. But credibility was highest up on top. You had to be credible and you had to do good work. Just as you said, you were quite hard on yourself for today. Well, women are.
Yes.
Women are very hard on themselves and they want to be perfect all the time. So I just think that takes extra work, and you start fitting in. And then when you start making good decisions and get credibility, then you start bringing in some of your different collaborative styles, your methods, and then you get respect for it. You have to hold your integrity at the highest level. But I find that organizations that prioritize diversity, equity, and inclusion at a very, very early stage, and they see that happening around the boardrooms, around the executive tables, around how you treat others at all levels, it really helps position and support and empower women to succeed. So I think we have to set that by example. And volunteering and helping others comes naturally to me because I saw my family do that, specifically my dad. And as we watched, we were his little helpers from a young age. Mm-hmm. And so that just came naturally. And then when you're passionate about things, your body speaks, and then people follow you. But they watch you. You know, we're watched all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to hold ourselves at the highest level and work harder to earn that credibility.
Can I just jump in on that? You touched on it, and I think it's really important to highlight that perfectionism or that need to always go above and beyond for women, because you might be the first in that room. That also comes with such an intense pressure.
Yes.
That often leads to burnout, especially in the nonprofit sector. And I just see that so often, and something that we have to be mindful in. How do we start to take that pressure off of one another? Because we have to be allies to one another around that as well, because it's just such a risk for our organizations if that's consistently what the expectation is of women.
I think that's a fantastic point, Michelle, and you both have said these things that just resonate with me so deeply. The idea of having credibility, I agree, Yasmin, is key. And I think the question a lot of the time is when, for, at least for me, when there is no path or there is no example, and I think you can both relate to that, when you're forging your own path, how do you even know, right, that you're on the right path? So for me, I had to, you know, have a long conversation with myself about who am I? Am I someone who tries to be collaborative and tries to get along and work with people and is open-minded? Yes. So even when, you know, other noises in the room are saying, you know, you're not going to get anything done that way, I had to really think, I know who I am. And I might not know the whole path, but I know who I am, and I'm going to step forward on that basis. And, it's not really much of a deep story, but I remember early on thinking, I am not myself when I'm wearing a suit. I am not. You know, attending in court, of course, you have to, but in the regular day-to-day, that's just not me. And I stopped doing that a long, long time ago, not because I think there's anything wrong with women wearing suits, but it's because that's not when I feel the most powerful. And it's a small thing, but I think it is something that factors into how you deliver who you are and you deliver, you know, your credibility and your hard work. And I agree. I mean, I don't think male or female, leadership comes with a lot of hard work behind it. And it's not one time only. It's those small commitments to showing up every single day and doing your best, even when it's hard or you're tired or your kids are sick. I think even sitting here with both of you today, I know I'm going to go home and think about what you've both said. And I think just knowing that two of you and many others, women in leadership, are out there in the community doing these great things and having these same, you know, feelings and discussions and forging forward. So we've talked about the not-for-profit work, and we know that it involves collaboration and community engagement. So I think this moves really nicely into, you know, how do we as female leaders foster this partnership and collaboration? You know, we've got a lot of different voices out there, a lot of different and sometimes conflicting interests in that sector. How do we do that?
Yeah, I can maybe jump in here. Having both worked in the nonprofit sector and then been on boards, I think one of the really significant challenges, and I noticed it more in Edmonton than I did in Regina when I lived there, is there are a lot of nonprofits in the landscape here, and there's a lot of overlap in the work that they're doing. But unfortunately, there's so much competition for funding that there tends to be a lot more competition rather than collaboration that's happening in that space. So where those opportunities are, I think, find that alignment. And I see it happen with the YWCA all the time, and I'm really proud of the work that's been happening there. Of, you know, they step up and they act as a fiscal agent for some nonprofits who otherwise wouldn't be able to get funding because they're not a registered charity. And those tend to be those smaller nonprofits that are serving equity deserving groups.
Yes.
First Nations or Indigenous led organizations, and that are really taking a lead on things like the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis. It's really powerful when you can find that alignment with your cause and help bring people to the table. The space they have on 124th Street, you know, it's available at no cost for other nonprofits. So they get to use that space, bring people together, host sessions for their teams, their boards, etc. And so I just think if we can find ways to say who else is in this space and how do we work together for the betterment of those that we serve, we're going to be so much more successful as organizations, but also as a community. So I'd really love to see more of that. And I think that we have that opportunity collectively to really champion that work.
And I would add exactly to what you said. I have worked with so many organizations, and collaboration and partnership work well when they have mutually beneficial programs. We're both win out of that. So you start by identifying your shared goals and values, and then foster open and transparent communication so that you're listening actively to the perspectives of both organizations. Mm-hmm. Once you've established that, you start on your collaborate on strategic planning cycle, work together, develop the strategic plans where those shared goals and values articulated and stated clearly, and then you can offer each other resources and expertise. You know, you can take your organization's resources, expertise, and networks and support them with their initiatives and bring theirs along. You can help them with funding, in-kind support, technical support, share the stakeholders and help each other with decision makers. And then you look at promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion into how you operate. And then the next thing is to build capacity and endowment. You look at supporting the capacity efforts of both organizations in whichever form that they take, with mentorship and strengthening the organization's capabilities and effectiveness. And then you start measuring and evaluating impact. Say, how did we do? What are other things that we want to put in so that we can do even better? And then you adapt and you learn. And then you look at the partnerships and you say, this is evolving over time. Our needs are changing. Do we need to evolve our shared values and objectives and then go into the cycle again? And by approaching these principles, you can bring in good, strong, mutually beneficial partnerships that foster inclusivity, collaboration, and can have collective impact to both organizations. If you've done many of those and you become friends, you help each other, and then you get into more other initiatives together.
When I hear both of you talking, the question that comes to my mind is, how do we get to the table in the first place? Is it something that we need to just move through the community and do, you know, be it ECF or something else? Or is it the leaders of the not-for-profit who need to all get together in a room and say, is there a different way we can do this? And do you think that that's something that would be on the horizon for people?
We've done it both ways.
Okay.
And one of the things we've done is we've had, so when we got all the groups together, we kind of had a focus group and talked about three or four top issues that we were going to talk about. So we kind of had a structured method to that. And then we're putting in ideas on how that could work. So it was bottom up. When we had institutions, we were looking at their strategic plan and how does it relate to what they're doing in the communities? And how can we look at that angle? Yeah. So then we did both of that. We got both groups together and brainstormed it. And then it was amazing. Out of this one or two sessions, we came up with a lot of good ideas. And then we looked at the quick terms of reference to say what could be the shared goals and objectives and how can we move forward. And so they work really well. Some structured, some who you know and who you can trust to have the first the model work, and then you can replicate it very quickly. And working with communities, when you look at communities, developing communities, developing capacity, there's so many similarities. So once you start, once you do one, you can replicate it with minor adjustments to other areas. And so that works really well.
Sure. And of course, then like curating it to how that organization would best function, right, with the people that they have and the capacity that they have.
Yeah. Yes, and one of the things we've done is being very culturally sensitive,
right,
and really be sensitive to where they're located and what barriers they're facing. And we may not be able to see it being away, but when you're there and you're looking at it from their voice, you can feel it.
Right.
And so the solutions are a little bit different based on, you know, where what their challenges are. And another thing that works really, really well is get the community to come up with solutions. And then you start looking at how can I build that capacity? So that way they take ownership and they want to make it successful. And they do not let you fail with that. So when they come up with solutions, and then you can say, how can we work together so that we can expedite that and we can build resources so that it's mutually beneficial?
That sounds great. Michelle?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a different view on it, in just that I think it's the structures, the funding methods that actually have created this problem. And so I think ECF is an example of someone who has an opportunity to really make a change in this space. I've had this conversation with government funders in the past, because at the end of the day, the reason that we're often in competition with each other is because we're competing for those funds. They don't tend to incentivize collaboration across the industry. And so there are ways on the funding side of things, the funders who are actually holding the purse strings can actually shift the culture within the not-for-profit sector. Because we, you know, we do work together in this space. We see each other all the time. You know, I've been part of CEO forum groups. We're dealing with all of the same issues. The problem is the current landscape doesn't actually work for us to work together. And so when you're at each other's throats for funding, it's really hard to come up with community-based solutions and actually address these things. And funding is the number one issue that every organization is dealing with in the nonprofit sector. COVID was not nice. And there were several really hard years well before that. And so there were a lot of organizations that had to shut their doors. There are people who had to make mass layoffs or really hard decisions within their organizations. And that's still happening now. You know, recent budget wasn't very generous to the not-for-profit sector either. And so I think at the end of the day, we really have to look from the top and look at the top-down approach as well. At the community level, we want to work together, but if the funding doesn't actually allow for it, it's going to continue down the same path.
And so if you have an idea, Michelle, of what that would look like by way of a change, because I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a couple of years ago, the provincial government did come up with a slightly different model for, and I'm trying to remember which funding it was, but it was this kind of hub and spoke model. So there was kind of an organization that was applying for the funding, but they were working with a variety of other organizations, but it was all coming through one. So it was really, the intention around that was to encourage collaboration. I think that we do need to look at how we create space for organizations to come together to look at community-wide solutions, but actually fund it so that that's not, oh gosh, we just had to spend a half day or a day off site and we lost that time. And now we're having to, again, going back to the burnout conversation, right. How do we ensure that organizations can come together with a more of a community-based model or funding approach to address these things and come to an ECF and say, we think we can solve this issue. We need these 10, 12, 15 partners at the table in order to do it. Here's the roles and responsibilities of each. Here's how we're going to report and stay accountable to you. But the dollar amount attached to that is considerable. Oh, and we need more than 1 year funding with no renewal option, with an expectation that you find a way to make that sustainable beyond the first year. Impact doesn't happen in a year. And that's the reality, right. Is oftentimes that's what these grants are. It's one-time funding for a year for a new project, not something you're already doing. And then you have to figure out a way to sustain it beyond that, even if you had amazing outcomes. And that creates so many challenges. And as women, the other side of that is that it's often women, newcomers, First Nations women, others who are in these precarious roles as well. So they're brought on for this one-year project and they don't have guaranteed job stability beyond that. So when that grant is up, so is their job.
Right.
So it just creates an entire system of challenges that is unevenly impacting equity-deserving groups.
I think that's a really profound statement. When I hear you talking and I think about what Yasmin has said as well, where I land is we have to continue to be out of the box or original or like beyond the landscape as we know it, as leaders or CEOs or even chairs of boards, when it comes to continuing to make sure that at the core, which is to help the community, that we are able to continue to have that improve. And I mean, obviously we know that structure needs to be in place, but as you've also said, Yasmin, and you as well, Michelle, there needs to be an actual understanding of, you know, that group or that part of the community and how they feel and how they're affected in order to help them achieve more stability. And I agree with you, Michelle. I do think that anything that is funded that is a year, you know, the return on anything in the first year, as we all know, no matter what you're doing or what kind of job you have, that's not enough of a measure to be able to determine what could actually happen. So I very much appreciate you saying that. And that is the point of today. We're not just here to talk about all of the great things. I think we're here because we know that there are many, many things that we can continue to do and see active change in a positive way. In each of our respective roles and beyond. But that doesn't happen when we're not willing to continue to look at it. And being able to shift very quickly and understand that what was happening 5 minutes ago may not be what's happening now, and still being able to handle it is I think, one of our many strengths as women in leadership.
That was part one of our two-part panel discussion about women in leadership. We can't thank Manel, Yasmin, and Michelle enough for joining us. Head on over to our show notes to learn more about our incredible panelists.
That's also where you'll find links to the latest on Edmonton Community Foundation's blog and to upcoming granting deadlines and funding opportunities at ECF.
Well, that brings us to the end of the show.
Thanks for sharing your time with us.
And we hope you enjoyed it. If you do, please share it with everyone you know. Or mostly everyone.
And if you have a moment, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This is a great way to support the show and help new listeners find us.
Thanks again for tuning in. We've been your hosts, Anna Alfonso.
And Andrew Paul.
Until next time.
The Well Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation.
And is edited by Andrew Paul.
You can visit our website at thewellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Special thanks to Octavo Productions for our theme music.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.